right, cats and kittens, we are back with another very special stay-at-home self-quarantine episode of the BrandoCast. I always say it's special, but this one's really special because this is officially the first BrandoCast I've done since testing positive for COVID-19.
Oh, man.
Despite being fully vaccinated. Yes, I'm the idiot who went to the Foo Fighters at the Forum, came down with a sniffle 2 days later, and then ultimately got tested, and the test came back positive for the coronavirus. But that is not stopping me from talking to my guest today. It is round two with the professor. I don't know if that's his nickname, but it should be. He is the host of the great, the fantastic Record Store Day podcast, where he gets to talk to all kinds of amazing people like Chris Difford from Squeeze, Julianna Hatfield, Todd Rundgren. I believe he's got an episode with Andy Partridge of XTC coming down the pike pretty soon. And of course, he's a noted author and just an all-around encyclopedia of music. That's the description that only fits one person on the planet Earth. And that is Mr. Paul Myers. Hello, sir.
Brandon, you're too kind as always. I appreciate you you mentioning all those things, and I know many of encyclopedias who are much more encyclopedic than me, but I appreciate that. I am so sorry about your breakthrough. That's not the kind of breakthrough we want in this life.
No. No, but I'm feeling pretty good. It's about day 11 since my symptoms first showed up. I did a podcast with Steve Agee, and I started the show by saying, you know, dude, I got a slight sniffle. I'm totally fine. Everything is cool. But that slight sniffle was actually the coronavirus. So.
Steve Agee, by the way, is one of my photographic heroes. Like, he's such a great... we know him as a comedian and actor, but check out his photography. He's just an amazing... I meant anyone else. Check it out on... I guess Instagram's a good place to look. But I love Steve's work.
I can't believe you just said that, because now I feel stupid because I wanted to say that to him.
I'm so sorry.
On the podcast, but it's true. And I love his take on Americana.
Yes.
Like, if that guy sees a garage out on a roadside somewhere with an old vintage sign, he gets an amazing photo of it. So what a great description. But
And of course, he's now a heavy rocker, too. So I just point out that his record, Scab, is an amazing rock record. I just wanted to say that since we're talking about Steve.
You just know so much about so many things, and I'm so excited to talk to Paul today, because we're going to talk about the Talking Heads today. But first, I want to get an update on all things Record Store Day podcast. And to people listening to this podcast, if you haven't subscribed to it, please go and do it now. It's such a great podcast, especially for those of us who love music. So just give me an update on that.
Well, I mean, we're about to finish our second season and pretty much start up our third season right away. But you mentioned earlier that I talked to Andy Partridge. Now, the last time I was on your show, I talked about XTC, and I was quite the fanboy. And I know Andy. I've known Andy for years, but we don't hang out, obviously. He's in Swindon, England. But we had an incredible... This was probably one of the longest and best chats. We talked for 90 minutes. I might even run the whole 90, even though my show usually doesn't go that long. He was open for anything. Album covers, talked about working with Hypnosis, the guys who did the Pink Floyd album covers. He talked about working with the Talking Heads, actually, which is so funny because that comes in here today because we're talking about Talking Heads. We've had Chris and Tina from Talking Heads on twice now. Well, Chris was on twice. Tina and Chris came on another time to talk about Tom Tom Club. But that was a career thing for me too, to talk to Chris France, because he'd written that excellent book, Remain in Love. And I got to talk to Elvis Costello, and you mentioned Julianna. Did you mention Julianna Hatfield? And Tanya Donnelly. We have an episode with Jane Wiedlin of the Go-Go's. And I have to say, I was in there before the Go-Go mania hit. So I was. She knows my loyalties. And then also the Bangles, to be fair. Not that they're always mentioned in the same breath because they're LA women bands. But Susanna Hoffs came on and talked about her record collection. And if you know her, and she's just an amazing record collector, music nerd herself. So we have a wide range of guests. We even had Jean-Baptiste from he's a musician, but he's also the guy from the Colbert Show. And Questlove's been on twice. It's just people who talk about records, and we have some, you know, emerging artists as well as big names. But I mentioned the big names just because everyone wants to hear about big names all the time. But we had the Black Pumas on. We've had different, you know, and it's just a really fun venue for me. And listen to me rambling. Sorry.
No, it's fun for me. And there's nothing that I would rather do than do this. I mean, I'm so now grateful that this format has been invented. Yeah. And those of us who are fortunate enough to talk to some of our heroes, you know, like you mentioned, Susanna Hoffs. I mean, for me, what a highlight of the pandemic of talking to her on Zoom and talking about all the great 60s music that inspired her as an artist. It's just a really neat thing to do. And you know, obviously doing this today, I mean, what a better activity for me to do during self-isolation.
Yes, exactly. Well, that's the thing I think has been great about podcasting. I was doing Zoom interviews before all the lockdown stuff happened because I'm up here in the Berkeley area of Northern California. So I'm not in LA and I'm not in New York and I'm not in like some of London and all the major centers. So I had to get pretty good at, you know, dialing up these places, but the technology's getting better and better all the time. And, you know, in the old days, wouldn't have been able to do this at all. So I'm really happy that, you know, we are connecting in that way. Do you want to talk about Talking Heads now?
Well, I want to ask one final thing about Northern California. Can you give me any sort of fire update?
I can't. I haven't checked today. The air is really clear where I am. I was in a place called Murphy's, which is, towards Yosemite. I was there about a week and a half ago, and the smoke was blowing in from some of the fires that later became the South Reno Tahoe fire, the South Tahoe fire. And we were close enough, you know, that we wanted to get the hell out. We got out early, basically. We weren't told to leave. The smoke was like a 355 AQI, which is not good. Luckily, neither my wife and I are immunocompromised or anything, so we could survive it, but we wanted to get out of there. We also wanted to keep the roads clear, so we got out before they might have needed them for evacuation. That's how life is now. If you live near the... And it happens in Southern California, too. And it's... I will say that I think it's hilarious that anyone would blame the governor for that stuff, because it's anyway, but that's a whole other thing. I've just heard it lopped in with the whole recall, you know, Michigas. But anyway, everyone's doing what they can. I think we could do more to, you know, climate change is upon us. But that's my soapbox. And for now, I got more to say on that on twitter.com if you want later.
Well, I agree with you. Also, please, people, send in your fucking recall ballot. No, just mark it no. Leave it blank. Yeah. Mark it no. Send it in. God damn it. You don't want Larry Elder being the fucking governor of California.
Exactly.
A lunatic. I read a little story the other day that when everyone evacuated South Tahoe, some of the bears came down in for the mountains. Obviously, they're fleeing the fire themselves, but they realize, like, oh, all the garbage is out. We can, like, hit everyone's trash can and have a feast.
Oh, my God. Salad bar. Yeah, absolutely. So I say, all those picnic baskets. Yeah.
Exactly. I say, leave South Tahoe to the bears. That's my pitch. If I'm the governor of California, let's just turn South Tahoe into Bear Town.
There you go. And remember, electing Larry Elder would be a boo-boo to bring it back to Yogi. I don't know, not the best joke. Anyway, no. Continue.
Anyway, fair enough. All right, let's start our very awesome discussion about the Talking Heads. I'm going to change the format of the BrandoCast up a little bit because I've got the professor with me today. But let me just say, Talking Heads were an American rock band formed in 1975 in New York City, and they were active until 1991. The band was comprised of David Byrne, Chris France on drums, Tina Weymouth on bass, and Jerry Harrison on keyboards and guitar. Described as one of the most critically acclaimed bands of the 70s and 80s, the Talking Heads helped pioneer new wave music by integrating elements of punk, art rock, funk, and world music with their avant-garde sensibilities. As former RISD students who became involved in the 1970s New York punk scene, Talking Heads released their 1977 debut album, Talking Heads 77, to positive reviews. After that album, the band collaborated with producer Brian Eno on a trio of critically acclaimed records, More Songs About Buildings and Food in 1978, Fear Music in 1979, and Remain in Light in 1980, which blended their art school sensibilities with influence from artists such as Parliament Funkadelic to Fela Kuti. The band played their first gig as Talking Heads, opening for the Ramones at CBGB's on June 5th, 1975. Paul, those are just some very simple, very simple notes from Wikipedia that I've sort of altered a little bit. But just let's just starting the conversation by me asking, what do the Talking Heads mean to you?
Oh, well, the Talking Heads were... Okay, for me, growing up, you know, I was a Beatle kid, and then punker new wave happened, and I was a Ramones fan and all that stuff. But then what happened was in 1970, I guess, 6 or 7, probably 77 now that I think about it, I heard Talking Heads 77, so that makes sense. And my brother Peter brought it home, and it... I had heard some of it on the local sort of alternative rock station, CFNY in Toronto, and I just was amazed by the kinetic and frenetic energy that it wasn't punk, it wasn't prog, it wasn't old-fashioned rock and roll, it wasn't metal, of course, and it just felt new and different. And the only analogy I had was the band I talked to you about the last time I was here. XTC were doing this kind of thing in England that had this herky-jerky kind of energy. And it was new and interesting, and the lyrics weren't about things that I'd heard people sing about. I think this was before I heard Devo, too. So they were the first herky-jerky band that I heard from the New York world. I lump in Devo with New York because they had moved to New York from Athens, Georgia. I know, listening people out there, you're listening, and you're saying he called them New York band. But anyway, so Talking Heads immediately made me curious. Of course, the first thing you hear is David, because David Byrne had that unique sort of, at the time, more of a yodel-based style, much like Andy Partridge did in XTC. And I was like, this is interesting. My dad, who didn't really listen to a lot of the same music that I did, started liking them. He was like, he would come in and go, ay, 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 ay. And I was like, oh, yeah, you're listening to my Talking Heads. I get it. Yeah, like he heard it in the other room. He only liked two other bands that I listened to. And I think one of them was Supertramp at the time. He really liked Logical Song. But he also liked Talking Heads, Psycho Killer, and I think it was Found a Job. He was like, every time those songs were on in my bedroom, he'd go, what is that? That's good. And so that's kind of neat. But anyway, so I just became a follower. Eventually, you know, started buying all the records. And every time they played, every time they made a new record, it kind of had a different element of what they'd done before and built upon it, which was the exciting thing about all the new wave-ish bands, was that everybody was trying to do something new. And it wasn't just the same. And, you know, it was different than other people and different than themselves every time out. So I just respected that.
Now, I don't know how extensively the Talking Heads toured in their early version, but did they come to Toronto early on?
Yeah, they did. And I didn't go to this show because I was maybe either too young or not connected, but they played the Ontario College of Art. And they played a gallery called Mercer Union. And it's one of those things that anyone who was there, I'm sure there was only 150 people there, but 3,000 people have told me they were there. It's a legendary gig, you know, because they changed the face of, you know, the Toronto scene just by being there. I missed that. The first time I saw them live was... actually it was pretty late. I finally got to see them up at an outdoor, you know, shed, one of those theme park places that has a summer concert stage. And I saw them, on stage at Canada's Wonderland, which is sort of like a Great America. In fact, I think it's the same company, and they couldn't use the term Great America in Canada, so they called it Canada's Wonderland, which is crazy. But so many great bands played at Canada's Wonderland, and Talking Heads played there on the, Speaking in Tongues tour. And I have a personal story about that, but I'll tell you that.
I want to hear it. I want to hear it now.
Okay, so everyone in Toronto went there. Everyone to this gig, because it was. I missed them at Heat Wave, which was a big concert that they did. That was like almost like the pre Lollapalooza. They had this thing called Heat Wave, and the promoters up in Toronto were these guys named the Garys, and they used to do these shows. But they did like the Police Picnic, which was a big show with the Police and all these other bands on it. But Talking Heads were like at Heat Wave, and that's the only reason I would have gone to this venue that was 300 miles away or something. It was literally 100 miles away, I think. Wow. Someone in Toronto knows. It's probably a lot closer, but it seemed 100. And everybody, I had missed that show because I was like, I'm not going to old-fashioned festival concerts, man. Anyway, you know, and now I regret it because I think there were so many great bands on that day. But anyway, I didn't want to make that mistake again. So I went to see them at Canada's Wonderland. And years later, only a few years later, I met the woman who is now my wife. And about 5 years later, I guess. It was actually a few years later. Anyway, I don't know why it matters that I get the year right. I was saying, oh, well, I like Talking Heads. I saw them up at Canada's Wonderland. She goes, I was there. And I said, oh, I was like row 15. And I had my stub because I kept stubs in those days. And I said, I was like right about here. And she said, I was over here. Like, and it was three rows over and five rows up. And it was one of those things when you're just meeting someone and you're falling in love. It's like, we both were at the same show. We didn't even know it. And so it became something that it just like, you love Talking Heads. I love Talking Heads. I was at that show too, you know. So it was really cool. And the only other thing that I want to say about Talking Heads' influence in Toronto, there's a band called Martha and the Muffins, who you might know.
I do not know Martha and the Muffins.
Well, some people who are into like the new wave stuff knew this song called Echo Beach, which was like a cult record, you know, and it came out on an English label. Well, Martha and the Muffins were our local like art rock heroes. They're kind of like a local Talking Heads, and they had their own thing. But the year that Talking Heads went sort of the funkier nine piece band, which we'll talk about in a minute, I guess. Martha and the Muffins came out with their next record that had all those sounds. Like they were, and we knew that they were on the same wavelength as us. Like it was like, oh, you guys were at that show too. Like it was like one of those things where it'd be like if X had gone to see like Fela Kuti and the next X album has like African drumming on it, you'd be like, ah, you were there too. Anyway, I'm trying to translate for Los Angeles people there. Anyway, so those that was a very personal connection to me, is that that Talking Head show. It was the one that tour was filmed for Stop Making Sense. So that was right. That was what we saw. That's the show I saw.
Was them sort of at their creative apex in a way.
Although I found out later from Chris's book that there was a lot more creativity that I didn't pay attention to how influential it was after that. But go ahead.
Well, I was going to say there are three periods of time, that three scenes that I fantasize about. Like if I could build a time machine and transport myself to specific places in time for music, it's this. It would be London in the sort of Sergeant Pepper's era, Bag of Nails era.
Gotcha.
So I can see all of my heroes, but I can also see bands like The Move, early Jeff Beck group. I also fantasize about Los Angeles in 1965. The Byrds are playing at Ciro's on Sunset. The Sunset Strip is happening. The Wrecking Crew and Phil Spector are just cranking out hit after hit after hit. I want to be friends with Sonny and Cher.
Absolutely.
And then the other period of time that I fantasize about is CBGB's in the mid-70s. Because to me, the fact that you could have seen the Talking Heads with the Ramones or the Talking Heads with Blondie or Television in a tiny little room is just mind-blowing to me. I'm working on a very secret project right now, which I can't talk about, with my friend Amit Zappa. But because of this top-secret project, I'm immersing myself in the history of CBGBs. And some things are just meant to be. And to have these four art school students there at CBGBs in the mid-70s is just mind-blowing to me.
Oh, yeah, and Patti Smith was there, and, you know, Television... just amazing. All the energy that was going south from they had been up at the Mercer Arts Center before that, like the New York Dolls had just happened, and this environment, and you know, and Chris in his book, Chris France, talks about just how dodgy that neighborhood was, the Bowery. But you know, people went down there, and the photographer Godless is a Godlis. And Chris Stein, they both documented this in photographs. You see what it looked like on the streets, and you see Joey outside CBGB talking to Debbie, and it's the Talking Heads even asked Debbie to be their front person at one point when they were forming the band. Chris and David went up to and sort of said, hey, what are you doing, you know, and Chris Stein was like, you know, no, she's working with me, we're doing this thing, and you know, it all worked out. But but yeah, no, I agree with you. The time travel thing is heavy for me. In fact, I think I just sort of mentioned this the other day to name drop, but Edgar Wright, because he's got a film about the last night in Soho, and it's kind of a dream fantasia about going back to a mythical London that was exciting. And I'd just been in London recently, and I, every time I walk through like Soho or any of these, you know, walk past Abbey Road or something in the, in, you know, Northwest London, I would sort of feel like, oh, imagine what it would have been like getting in an MG and driving across London to go visit the Beatles at Abbey Road or something. And it's very practical. It's not like a, in my mind, it's not like a crazy thing. I'm thinking, I wonder if they had tea. I wonder if they had a cafeteria in this dude. Like I was just trying to figure out what the actual day would be like working at Abbey Road. Anyway, so I'm with you all the way about the New York scene. And that's why we're here talking about Talking Heads. I brought it.
Yeah,
back.
Well, I it's so interesting because when I visited a city, the first places that I visit in a city are their cool record store and their historic music venue.
Right.
When you were talking to Chris Difford on your podcast, the latest version, you started talking to him about sort of some of the sites and places that he's written about.
Yes.
In London. And you basically said to him, I almost wanted to do a walking tour of these places that you've described. And for those bands that communicate those places to us, I think just for those of us who are fans of music, it just gets in our DNA. You know, I've been to CBGB's once, way after everything important had happened there. Yeah. But when I listen to that music, I can imagine myself in those places. So it's just kind of magical.
No. And so Talking Heads represented a connection to that. And like I said, the creativity. And then they go and hook up with Brian Eno. And like that was amazing to me because I had just been going through a Brian Eno rediscovery of his solo pop records, and but also I think he just started doing the ambient records, and all of a sudden he's producing Talking Heads' follow up album, More Songs About Building and Food, and all of a sudden it's like, oh wow, so things were aligning here, like so all the cool progressive things, like, and I say progressive not in prog sense, but all the artists from the old guard, like Roxy Music and stuff, were kind of listening, and Bowie, they were all listening to what was happening in New York. And you were like, oh, good. So it's energy and it's new. And these guys who I believed in are also believing in the new stuff too. And they're, you know, Robert Fripp's getting on board, and Robert Fripp plays on Fear of Music. And you sense that it's a continuum more than just more than a straight break, you know?
And yeah, totally understood. No, totally understood. I'm also just thinking as we're talking about all this stuff that I know that Rush fans will visit Lakeside Park when they go to Toronto.
Yeah, and I used to pass it all the time because I grew up in Toronto. And actually, I'm from Willowdale, which is the suburb that they're from. And I've even gone to concerts at Earl Haig Collegiate, which I think is where Alex and Getty met.
Unbelievable.
So, but like, yeah, Rush are the Northern Toronto, it's the equivalent of Run DMC is to Hollis Queens. Like you can't throw an album around without hitting something that's a Rush landmark, you know? And I imagine Talking Heads, and David Byrne grew up in Hamilton, Ontario. He was born in Dumbarton, Scotland, but he also, I don't think he's ever become a U.S. citizen. It's interesting. So David Byrne, one of the great American frontmen, is actually not even American.
The Talking Heads hit their commercial peak in 1983 with the U.S. top 10 hit Burning Down the House from the album Speaking in Tongues, and also their legendary concert film Stop Making Sense, which was directed by Jonathan Demme. In 1985, Talking Heads released their best-selling record, Little Creatures. They went on to produce a soundtrack album for the David Byrne film True Stories in 1986 and released their final album in 1988, and that was the world beat influenced Naked. The Talking Heads disbanded in 1991. They were also inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2002. Now, the reason that I didn't do a more thorough sort of history of the Talking Heads, as sometimes I do with other bands, is that their history of the Talking Heads, especially for someone like you, is so dense and so important. I would just, you know, encourage people to get out there and, you know, do your own research. But, you know, in your opinion, why did it have to come to an end, and why did they never resurrect it?
Well, this is where I sort of feel like the child of divorce. I don't want to side with any factions, but there were factions, and ironically, also XTC had the same kinds of problems. So neutrally, I will tell you that there was a lot of discussion about what is and what isn't a Talking Heads career. And David was doing a lot of things on his own that he wanted to pursue. And but to me, Talking Heads is a band. You know, the name of this band is Talking Heads. It was the name of one of their releases. And to me, what made Talking Heads Talking Heads was Jerry, Chris, Tina, and David. And here's the thing. There are people who side with, they sort of go against David, saying that he was just the whatever, you know, maniacal, whatever. And there are also people who are think David's the only thing that made Talking Heads interesting. I will tell you, Talking Heads, if you listen closely to Chris and Tina, Tina Weymouth, one of the most interesting bass players, like she had funky lines that went up and a little bit McCartney at times, like she would sinew her way in things. And Jerry Harrison, all-rounder, perfectly grounded piano, organ, and then these guitar parts. And the interplay between David Byrne and Jerry Harrison is, I always think of Television as being a band that did this thing where you have two great, clean guitar players up front, and they somehow make this thing that doesn't sound too busy, and you can pick out both guitar lines. And Jerry and David together were just incredible. So there's a lot of, and then when Eno got involved, that also took a little bit of the, there's a divide and conquer thing that happens when a producer sort of sidles up to the heavily artistic lead singer. So I felt like there was a little bit of that. It's not entirely black and white, because at one point it was Chris and Tina who got Jerry together to make what became Remain in Light. And David at that point was like, I'm not sure if I want to do a Talking Heads album this year. And they invited Brian Eno over, and then they called David and said, well, we've got Brian over here. We're already doing something. So why don't you come over? And it was like, oh, okay then. And so that, of course, that's in Chris's book. Anyway, I haven't had a chance to chat with David about that. Although I have chatted with David on occasion, on stage, actually, at the San Francisco Sketch Fest. But he has never been on my show, but he will be eventually, I'm sure. But my point is, it's complicated that way. I hope I've conveyed it in a way that didn't play favorites too much. There's a lot of personality issues. And then things just become ingrained as as an adult. You'll find that, you go through any kind of divorce or settlement with any or former employer or former colleague, things that were, innocent at first become bigger, and then they become huge, and then they become, we're not even talking. Or sometimes you have this come to Jesus moment where everyone just says, we're not getting any younger. I don't know. But again, it's also at a certain point you think, well, I hope they sort that out. I'm glad they left a great body of work,
Yeah, well said. I say this lovingly. I think musicians are uniquely crazy. I think it's almost impossible for a collective of musicians to stay together for longer than 5, 6, 7 years. If you think about the Beatles, from the time Ringo joins, you're really only talking about 7 possibly 8 years of being together to produce music. The Talking Heads are actually together a little bit longer than that. Very few of my favorite bands, except for Rush, stayed together for their entire career.
Yeah.
So it's kind of amazing, because I was just, thinking about that question, because, as a music fan, I often wonder, what would have been next? What would have been next for that band to deliver to the world? But, I know it's virtually impossible.
Yeah, I mean, and I actually wonder, I haven't asked Chris about this, but I wonder how the rest of the band felt about David's American Utopia going out and doing all these Talking Heads songs with a different band. I mean, he's got as much right as, I guess, the Tom Tom Club has to do that too, but it is interesting, and I'm sure it generates some income for everybody, so that's cool. But and Tom Tom Club, by the way, people forget they were a very successful offshoot. Like, they didn't just go away. They kind of create. Genius of Love is one of the most sampled tracks, and Wordy Rapping Hood was one of the, early on, I don't think there was a lot of songs with pop songs with rap in them, and hip hop culture was just sort of kind of making itself up at that time. So, and it's hard to underestimate, or it's easy to underestimate, just how influential Tom Tom Club were on their own. Would they have gotten the attention if they hadn't been out of Talking Heads? That's probably the case. They probably got a little more of a boost from that. But, as much as you know, B-52s or anything from that scene. I think Tom Tom Club stand on their own. And Jerry Harrison's a gifted and acclaimed producer who's made hit records and does a lot of work to this day. So they're all really talented. And, you know, and I just don't know. I think David's in a really good place now. I think if the others, you know, I don't think they need to make another record. I mean, ABBA did it. I mean, if ABBA can make a record,
that's crazy.
But ABBA never had the acrimonious split that these other bands did. So, but yeah. Still, I mean, you know, I hope it's not going to be a Free as a Bird situation, you know, because as much as I love Free as a Bird, it's a shame that they had to do it after John went. So, but, you know. Fans like to play these games, and we're playing those games. So they
and we're
go.
Playing those games. You know, I always was interested in Chris France because he went to high school in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Shadyside High School. I grew up in Pittsburgh, and I remember as a kid, like, oh, the drummer from Talking Heads is from Pittsburgh, because as great a city as Pittsburgh is, it actually doesn't have a ton of rock stars or a ton of. There's really not a band of significance that's come out of Western Pennsylvania like that. So he was always the guy. Well, there's Chris France, you know.
Yeah.
All right, so what we're going to do now, when I asked Paul to do the show, and we picked Talking Heads as the subject, he sent me a whole list of Talking Heads songs that are incredibly amazing, but not quite as popular as some of the big hits that people know about. So what we're going to do is we're going to just go through a couple of the tracks that Paul selected, and I'm just going to get his thoughts about those cuts and, you know, just see where the discussion takes us. So to begin with, let's hit play on Cross-Eyed and Painless from the album Remain in Lights. Okay, so Paul, why did you pick Cross-Eyed and Painless?
Well, that thing I was talking about with the interplay between the guitars and stuff like that, and of course also Eno, this is a great example of what, you know, everyone talked about how the Talking Heads had sort of gone to African music, but that wasn't just African music that they were incorporating or appropriating. They were also taking in a lot of American funk music, and a lot of the sort of approaches to, ensemble playing. Like they basically put more players on the record, but also had them playing less at a time. So you have these little little guitars. And then at the same time, what you notice is that David now has become a really smooth lead singer. Like, come on, liberty. And then the beautiful harmonies, all I want. And it's such a great evocative track of where the Talking Heads were at that moment. And that, to me, when I hear that, I'm immediately taken back to buying Remain in Light. And it was just such an amazing moment for me. And again, they'd blown my mind again. And it was like, just when you thought, the only hint you had was on E-Zimbra, the first track off Remain in Light that sounded like that. You know, E-Zimbra had this like, ha, E-Zimbra, and it was a little more African high life-y, and, you know, but they only did that for the one song, and then the rest of Fear of Music was a little bit more like an extension of Buildings and Food with a little bit more paranoia. And then all of a sudden, Remain in Light comes out, and it's like, whoa! It was a party record, too. Like, you could put that on. It's got, like, straight-ahead drumming, so it fits in the disco, but it's also funky. But it's also head music. There's all kinds of atmosphere. It's just, to me, that was a track that it sets the scene. Like, when I hear that, the minute I hear it, I'm like, ah, there we are.
Now, do you remember the record store that you bought Remain in Light at?
Yep.
What was it?
It was Record Peddler, which is a record store. they played a pun. They had a guy on a bicycle in their ad and their logo, and it was on Queen Street East, and it was next door to CITY City Television, one of the first sort of street level television studios in Toronto, and it was a very hip station. And Queen Street West was where everyone was hanging out, but Queen Street East had the Record Peddler, so you'd go there. And they used to have imports from England and also New York and all sorts of punk stuff and, you know, magazines and stuff. And I remember buying it. I can still remember the shrink wrap. And I had a shift that day at the restaurant I was working at. And I remember I had to listen to it in the morning and then it stopped. And I just kept thinking, when my shift is over today, I'm heading right back to listen to the Talking Heads. So it was a big day for me. That's why I remember it so well.
Wait, where were you working?
I was working at a restaurant called Mr. Green Jeans in the Toronto Eaton Center.
There's the coronavirus. It's a cough that came right out of the lab. Good Lord. Tell me about that place. I want to know about it.
Well, okay. So I actually ended up meeting my wife there, too. I was working there for quite a while. And she was a waitress and I was a busboy, but we were both waiting for a living, if you know what I mean. It was called Mr. Green Jeans. You had to wear blue jeans. They wore polo shirts that were like corporate polo shirts, like everyone wore the same shirt. I had to wear a green apron because it was supposed to have a gardening theme originally, but then they quickly dispersed of that. And then they would have the large salads in those days, and huge, massive bowls. And they had a dessert called Hats Off, which was a plexiglass top hat filled with ice cream and whipped cream. And it was like insane. People were encouraged to order it for birthday parties or something, you know, and we all had to sing happy birthday at tables. And they had these, but they had these potato chips that were made on site, like, so they're deep fried potatoes, fine cut. And they were called buffalo chips, and because they were chips. So you'd order like something and it comes with buffalo chips. And of course, you know, we gleefully telling people, do you want buffalo chips with that? And I probably worked so many of those shifts either hungover or on Benzedrine, because there was these little blue pills going around, because we'd all be out at night. We'd all be out partying all night. I was still trying to make it as a rock star, and that wasn't happening, I guess. But I would come in the next day and I'd just be like numb. But the funny thing is, I met so many of the people that I still know. One of my friends is a Toronto broadcaster named Richard Krause. He was a bartender there, and my wife was there, and several of my good friends to this day. It was a little like college for me, because I didn't go to college, but I did listen to a lot of cool records and work with a lot of cool people for a few years. So if you ask,
well, that was your college.
It was in the Toronto. It was in a downtown mall called the Toronto Eaton Center. But Eaton is a name of a department store. So, very influential place, actually.
And did you start dating your wife when you were both working there?
Yes. Towards the end of my working there, I started dating her. And at one point, I think there was a class system at work or something, because I was a busboy and I didn't even want to be a waiter because, you know, I would have to think. And I got an office job right around that time. I worked in music publishing. And it was like partly just to get out of just to not be working with my girlfriend, because I just felt like it'd be complicated. And it was good. It was good to get out.
Yeah. And it worked.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay.
And I got better. I don't do Benzedrine anymore. I'll tell you that.
Well, you know, fuck it. With those kind of jobs, I mean, what are you going to do?
Oh, yeah,
you know?
Yeah. I was just, like I said, waiting for a living. You know, I was waiting for something to happen. But anyway. Okay. So, yeah. So then, and then we both went on to be Talking Heads fans. So then back to that.
Okay. Well, back to this. Back to the next song on Paul's sort of list of amazing Talking Heads songs that you might not know. This is another amazing one. This is from the Speaking in Tongues album, and this is Making Flippy Floppy.
Nothing can come between us. Nothing gets you down.
Well, I just love this record because they'd established in Remain in Light, they'd established this idea of being dense and trippy and funky and party. And then on Speaking in Tongues, we see David Byrne being light and fun. The lyrics are like all through this album, like Girlfriend is Better, and this is the album that has Once in a Lifetime on it, right? But Making Flippy Floppy is just, it's kind of fun, you know. And this is the same album that has This Must Be the Place, you know, Home is Where I Want to Be. And it's like a sensitive side to David Byrne as a lyricist and frontman. And musically, they were really coming up with like counter melodies and stuff. And it felt like it breathed a lot more, which is sort of evident when you see Stop Making Sense, the tour film. Yeah, Stop Making Sense.
The concert film. Yeah.
I always get confused that I think I said the wrong thing. Sense is Working Overtime is the XTC song, and I always say them backwards. And anyway, so Stop Making Sense really captures the fun of this music, and that was a new thing. You know, Fear of Music had been really dark. Remain in Light had some very dark tracks on it, and then all of a sudden, Speaking in Tongues was a party record with a beautiful Robert Rauschenberg album cover. So it was pretty cool. It was a very fun record, and I remember being very happy for them.
I imagine you as a hyper music fan like me, when you're a fan of a band, you want to go on the journey with them.
Yeah.
You want to be taken to a different place. So those sort of changes between records don't bump us necessarily like they bump some other music fans. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I would imagine that you as a fan, when you bought that record, you were like, okay, this is different. Take me on a journey.
Well, I just didn't go off to a different artist for a second. There's two other artists I can think of, or three. David Bowie, Elvis Costello. David Bowie and Elvis Costello are enough right there. And Joni Mitchell. So a lot of these artists that I love, they've managed to... You're in for the ride, like whatever they're into this week, I'll do that too. And XTC was the same too. Every XTC record was different, and for me it was great. But like I said, this was a clearer evolution, though. They went from funky and dark to funky and fun, and it was almost like they incorporated the fun of the first record, where they're singing like sort of a little more innocently, and then they found their re-innocence back, and it felt more like a team record too. It felt like they were a team. I felt like Speaking in Tongues had to be made by a band that was really functioning as a band, you know? Anyway.
Yeah, totally understood. Yeah, I remember as a Rush fan, when Rush went through their sort of, starting in the early 80s, but really mid-80s, late 80s, heavily influenced by Ultravox sort of synth period.
Yeah.
That was a tough one. For me, I bought all the records, but they were a different band in a way. So it can be jarring.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. I never thought of the Ultravox influence on Rush. Actually,
they've stated that they listened to the Police. They listened to,
I remember
Ultravox.
The Police part. I remember the Police. Yeah. I remember clearly hearing, Alex Lifeson, copying some Andy Summers, processing on his guitar for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. But now I can look back and go, thank God they just did whatever they needed to do to keep going. And I'm so grateful for that. I can't imagine that you have listened to the brand new number one in many countries in the world, the brand new Iron Maiden record, Senjutsu. That's a band that does one thing and does one thing incredibly well. But yeah, that's about it.
Well, you know, it's funny. I actually put a call out recently. I would love to get, we're trying to get Iron Maiden on the RSD podcast, actually. I don't know if I should mention it because I don't know if it'll happen, but I'm fascinated with him. You know, Bruce Dickinson is such a smart, smart guy, no matter what kind of music you like, you know?
Yeah, any man who can front a metal band and fly a 747.
There you go.
And at one point in time, he was ranked internationally as a fencer. So, you know, that's a high-achieving individual. All right, let's move on to the next song on Paul Meyer's list of incredible Talking Head songs. And let's hit play on Nothing But Flowers from the Naked album.
Now the thing about this again is, so this is almost like extra innings for this band. Like they've kind of done it all at this point. They've done, at this point in their career, they've done Little Creatures, they've done True Stories, they've kind of become as ubiquitous in the mainstream as REM, let's say. Like they were, they were kind of one of the MTV bands. They were the go-to. They were your friend who's square even knew a lot of Talking Heads song, and they probably thought they were the quirkiest band that they liked for songs that weren't quirky. Like they would have heard And She Was and thought, this is quirky. But I will tell you that I've come around to even appreciating Naked more than I did at the time, because it is, as you said, a world music record. It was recorded in Paris. They featured a lot of they had Steve Lillywhite working on it, who was a great producer who worked with XTC and Psychedelic Furs and U2.
Simple Minds,
yes. And they also had Johnny Marr do a guest spot on this record and Kirsty MacColl. So and a lot of West African musicians and who are living in Paris, and you know, and just a lot of the great sort of influences that could only happen in a place like Paris. And at the same time, they took this. It's almost like a happier version of Remain in Light again. Like they went dark and deep, but they did it in a way that had a bemused sense of humor. So Nothing But Flowers is essentially an environmental song, but it takes the flip side point of view, like in a Randy Newman kind of sardonic way, saying, you know, once we had shopping malls, now it's all covered with flowers, you know. That's, you know, like he's sort of saying, damn it, you know, Earth won again. And it's a dystopian song that sort of is gentle and smooth and just... I love that sort of thing. And it's funny, I keep mentioning XTC because there is this parallel track. XTC had a track called River of Orchids. River of Orchids by XTC is the same idea. It's not the same song, but there's a song. It's all about how the freeways are now are filled with flowers, and it's the same idea of, you know, if you've ever seen those there used to be science shows, I think, on Discovery Channel or something, where they would show if you left a city unattended for like 20 years, all the vines would grow up alongside of skyscrapers and trees would grow out of windows. And the idea that the earth is going to, you know, if you leave the earth alone, it will grow back. I mean, which, you know, that might not happen after a while. But I could bet on Earth, you know, if we take care of it, it could probably grow back. I don't know. But we definitely paved over everything, so it's hard to say. Flowers presents this in a very amusing way.
That's incredible. Where were you around this period of time with your wonderful music journey? Were you still doing a band at this point in time?
No,
in the late 80s?
I think, oh, well, yeah, wait a minute. That was, so whether it was 88. So, yes, yeah. Well, 88, I was in the thick of it. I was... forming, I think the Paul, I had already done a few bands that had broken up and had gone solo. And then I formed the Paul Myers Band, creative name, right? Yeah. And, the Paul Myers Band, morphed itself into the Gravelberries, which was a band that, was, you know, sort of the next few years. It was a very interesting time because I think I was immersing myself more. I was less of a fanboy around this time, to be honest. As I recall, I had sort of become an active participant in my own music. So I was less concerned with other people's careers that, like, instead of like the way I would have kept track of everybody and how they're doing, you know. And I wasn't, when I say how they're doing, I wasn't necessarily worrying about sales figures, but it was always nice to see when people voted for your favorite band. So like when Once in a Lifetime was a big hit, I remember thinking, oh, people are buying Talking Heads records now. That's cool. And when XTC had Mayor of Simpleton on MTV, I was like, oh, wow, people are buying XTC records. And because they wasn't always the case, as you know, as being somebody who's a fan of a band all the way long, you're like, you're used to mentioning something and having people go, I know Psycho Killer, and they don't know anything else. And you're like, well, that's fine. I mean, when you're younger, it matters more, I think. But I would be like, okay, but they're much more than the two songs you know. And so it's always nice when people had a profile. I don't know what Naked did sales-wise, because I wasn't even paying attention to how other people were perceiving these things at that point, because I was so busy with my own thing, you know?
Right. What would you say were the sort of the primary influences for the Paul Myers Band?
Oh, well, that's interesting. So I would say it starts... I was trying to be much more of a rock singer-songwriter, so I was deep into my Elvis Costello stuff, but I'm a huge fan of XTC, as you know. So I was definitely going for a British Robin Hitchcock, Andy Partridge, clever wordplay, to the point where people might say, stop being clever and just write a song. I think it was less about... I liked bands that were I didn't have to be a great singer. Although I later learned that there's a lot of great singing in all those records that I liked, but I remember thinking, well, you know, these people just sort of sing in a certain range that I can sing in. And so it was like XTC, it was like Elvis Costello, a little bit of Talking Heads came in. Talking Heads' influence was much more in the way I played guitar than anything else, and maybe trying to write songs about things that were different. Actually, my earlier bands were much more Talking Heads inspired. I had a song called I Wake Up Being, which was kind of an existential song about being alive and wondering what that, exploring it from all different scientific angles and, you know, that sort of thing. And just, it's embarrassingly new wave lyrics. but by the point of the time, 88, I was much more, you know, content to try and be sort of like Elvis Costello on Man Out of Time or those kinds of songs, or a little bit like Imperial Bedroom. And but also the Beatles kept coming up every so often.
I bet Nick Lowe was in that mix as well.
Nick Lowe was definitely, and I don't know why I didn't mention him right away. And Joe Jackson was another influence that I brought in a lot. And I was aware of those influences for sure. And I was just hoping I didn't sound like I was a bad version of those people, you know, because that's what happens.
Have you watched the, this is such a quick tangent, but have you watched the, there's a documentary, I think you can find it in the deepest corners of Amazon, that was put out a number of years ago about the Stiff Records tour of the UK in the late 70s when they put all the bands on one bus and just toured around. Have you watched that? Because I feel like that was you.
Yeah.
That was like your, you could have been a Stiff Records artist.
That would have been amazing. Was that Endless Grey Ribbon? Is that the one? Because that's a Rockpile movie. Yeah. No, I haven't seen this movie, I don't think, because I think I would remember it.
I
know the stories of those tours. I mean, definitely that was Costello's biggest pill popping era. I think they were all out of their heads on those tours.
Yeah, it's kind of a fun movie for people listening to the podcast because Ian Drury is on the bus and Nick Lowe is on the bus, and they don't lean so heavily into Elvis Costello. By the time the movie had come out, was a big star. They just sort of put him in the mix of everybody. But it's really interesting because it also gets into the employees that work for Stiff Records in London and just their whole ethos. And, you know, they just get on a bus and travel around the UK. And everyone's sort of a friend. So it's kind of interesting. All right, let's move on to one final song. This one is, it's a classic, I think. It's from Fear Music, and this is Heaven.
Well, Heaven is interesting to me because, as I was saying, you start to follow that David Byrne as a front man was starting to be more traditional in a sense. You could relate to this song relates to Neil Young to me. Like, I feel when I hear the way he sings, you know, the chorus especially, you know, heaven is a place where also the lyrics, a place where nothing ever happens. The band in heaven plays my favorite song, and there's it's the scientific David Byrne making a list kind of what would that be, just like a stand-up comedian would, you know. They have a, you know, stand-up comedians, I'm not a stand-up comedian, but I know that they do things like they'll have one joke, but then they'll try and make several jokes to make a chunk out of a bunch of bits, and it has a through line. And I think David Byrne sometimes would take a subject and then and attack it from different sides in the lyrics and then sort of explore it. And then he was also self-conscious, I think. I don't know if he was self-conscious, but I presume he was self-consciously saying, isn't it weird that I'm doing this in a song? So Heaven had this thing where on its face, it's a very serious, almost country song, but there's also kind of there's a lot of these sort of deadpan lines in it. Like, it's hard to imagine that nothing at all could be so much, to be so exciting, could be so much fun. And it's meant to provoke a little bit of thought or conversation, I think. At the same time, he's singing a beautiful melody on top of it, and it's just, and the drumming straight ahead, and it could be a trucker band. It's like, it's, it felt like a moment on that album too, which was, you know, Fear of Music, which I read the 33 and a third about. It's a very, very interesting period in their career. Like it's a, like I said, I keep saying it's a very dark album. Everything about that album, Fear of Music, is about some aspect of a challenge, like animals. Animals is a hilarious song on that record. He talks about animals think they're pretty smart. See shit on the ground, see in the dark. Animals aren't helping. I don't take animals' advice. Like he's like dissing animals, like they're not good friends, you know. Like and paper. There's a song called Paper where he just talks about like hold on to the paper, you know, put it on, see if you can get it on the paper. He's just attacking a subject. Like the same way a stand-up comedian, if you see the set list for Fear of Music, it looks like it could be off Sarah Silverman's yellow legal notepad or something. Right. It's like, okay, I'm going to do Paper, then I'm going to follow with Air, because Air is another song on the record. And he's just sort of like, it's just sort of like a series of like titles that evoke an area that he explores lyrically. And musically, they were really breathing. They took the Buildings and Food sort of sense of denseness that they had established with Eno, and then they really followed through. And that's why I think they did Remain in Light afterwards, because I think they'd gotten as dark as they could get at that point and not immolate. So then the next record had to be a little bit more of a celebration, you know? So I think that, yeah, Fear of Music, it stands today as one of those records. It's not even, almost stands apart from the rest of their catalog. It's like what Rubber Soul is to Revolver, or what Revolver is to Abbey Road. Like, it's the album where they got a whole bunch of things right, and then it said, that's the end of that part of our career. So, I don't know. I'm thinking this stuff as I'm saying it.
I love it. I love it.
And you're also trust that I'm right, because I feel like I've thought this before.
Well, you know, it's I've learned from the great Michael DeBar, there's no really right or wrong. It's just sort of how you feel, and to celebrate the music in any way is an amazing thing. I agree with you. And listening to you, I'm realizing there's probably far more humor in Talking Heads music than people give them credit
for. Hilarious humor. Yeah, like, yeah, David Byrne, like stand-up for sure.
Right, and I think the Peter Gabriel era Genesis has the same thing. Like, if you read the lyrics of some of their really proggy stuff, I mean, there's so much humor
Battle
there.
Of Epping Forest is filled with them, and Counting Out Time from Land Lies Down. Gabriel and plays on words, you know, like just
right.
Yeah, Epping Forest is hilarious, by the way. Have you ever listened to it? Like, you know, it just to save my steeple, I visited people for this. I had gone and met Little John, whose name came. I understood when the judge said, "You are a Robin Hood." Like it's almost rap, you know.
Amazing.
He's freestyling.
I love it. Were you drawn more to lyrics, or were you more drawn to vibe, like music vibe?
Are you talking about Talking Heads here?
I'm talking about with almost everything.
Oh, because okay. I'll tell you, the first thing you always hear is vibe. But a key phrase will jump out. So if I hear a phrase that catches my ear, I will go, ooh, I think this is about this. And I won't even know. I won't remember all the lyrics, but I'll remember a rejoinder, you know?
Yeah.
You know, like when you first heard Creep and you heard Tom York go, "Wish I was special, you're so fucking special." And you're like, oh, that's a different take. That's a little aggressive. And then the chaka comes after the little guitar, and then all of a sudden they go into the sort of, you know, what's now predictable heavier part. But you know, and then other examples.
Well, you just describe why I love The Replacements so much.
Exactly.
Yeah, because you have vibe, you have intense sort of suburban anger, and then you have these incredible wordplay lyrics you know, always have a very interesting turn to them.
Westerberg in Alex Chilton, when he says, feeling like $100, exchange good lucks along the way or something like that. And like the phrase is feeling like $1,000,000. So when he says $100, you get it. Like, I hope I have the lyric right, but you get it, because he's saying I'm not feeling $1,000,000, but like there's this like self-consciously dowdy sort of distressed version of the reality. He never preached perfect. He always preached imperfect, and that's
everyone loves being afraid is if being afraid is a crime, we'll hang side by side.
There you go.
You know, that's the big one. All right, Paul, I have kept you for 1 hour. We have been nerding out on the Talking Heads for a full hour. So I just sort of want to wrap things up and give you another chance to promote all things Paul Myers out there in the world.
Well, I just there's two books that I've curated with Steve Lawden called, first book was called Go All the Way. It's an exploration of literary stories about power pop. And then the second one that just came out is called Go Further. Guess what? That's a sequel title, eh? So Go Further. And they've all these different authors basically under our curation writing about different aspects of power pop. We've got so many different kinds of people in there. Alison Andrews is in volume one talking about Nick Lowe, and you know, and we've got all kinds of stories. And Ira Robbins from Trouser Press writes a story for us, which is really great. And then of course there's the podcast, which is the Record Store Day podcast you've been gracious to mention. That's every 2 weeks, and you can look for it and subscribe. That would be great, because that's how we know people are listening. And other than that, I've got some things coming out in the new year that I can't talk about. I am working on a book about John Candy that I'm contracted to write that, and I've been interviewing. I've got another few months to work on that, but I'm interviewing all kinds of people. I got to chat with Catherine O'Hara for that, which was great. And I also chatted with Dan Aykroyd and Steve Martin. And I'm at that place now where I have to sit down and finally write it, but it'll be the follow-up to my Kids in the Hall book, I guess, in that way, because it's my second book about a comedy career from Canada. So
that's fantastic. Well, I hope that you'll come back on and so we can talk about SCTV and that book and, that sort of passion in your life, too, because I think that would be a really fun discussion.
I would love to do that.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for gracing me with your time today, Mr.
It's
Myers.
It's always really, really fun to talk to you, Brendan. And I love your passion for music. And I know it's a safe space to get excited and be a fanboy and talk about music. And I hope your symptoms subside, and let that be a warning to everyone that breakthroughs happen. But being vaccinated means you're not dead. Thank you. Thank you for being vaccinated.
Oh my God. It saved my life. I swear to God. And now I just have a strange metallic taste in my mouth, but thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll see you again soon.
Okay. And to the rest of you, thank you so much for listening, liking, subscribing. So many great guests coming down the pike. But of course, I mean, what's more fun than spending an hour with Mr. Paul Myers? Woo! And of course, the BrandoCast is produced by Mr. Richard Sheltinga. So until the next time, cats and kittens.
Mommy, daddy, come and look at me.